So, Gordy, how are things at the bank?
Gordy's smile wavered.
They'll keep. Anyway, you're not ready for a lecture on inflation. Listen, can you get away on the weekend? I thought we'd take the scouts up for a snow hike.
Boy, that sounds good. Clean snow. It was hard to believe that no more than an hour away in the Angeles Forest Mountains was deep snow and wild, whistling wind in the evergreens, while they stood here in their shirt sleeves in the dark.
Probably not, Gordy. There's a job coming up.
Christ, I hope there's a job coming up.
You better not count on me.
What about Andy? Thought I'd use him as patrol leader this trip.
He's a little young for that.
Not really. He's got experience. I'm taking some new kids on a first hike. Could use Andy.
Sure. He's up on his schoolwork. Where are you going?
Cloudburst Summit.
Harvey laughed. Tim Hamner's observatory wasn't far from there, although Harvey had never seen it. He must have hiked past it a dozen times. They discussed details. With the Santa Ana blowing, there'd be a melt-off on all but the top elevations, but there would certainly be snow on the north slopes. A dozen scouts and Gordy. It sounded like fun. It was fun. Harvey shook his head ruefully.
You know, Gordo, when I was a kid, it was a good week's hike to Cloudburst. No road. Now we drive it in an hour. Progress.
Yeah, but it is progress, isn't it? I mean, now we can get there and still keep a job.
Sure. Damn, I wish I could go.
By the time they'd driven up, an hour, and hiked in and got the gear out of their backpacks and set up camp and got damp wood burning and their backpack stoves going, the freeze-dried mountain food always tasted like ambrosia. And coffee, at midnight, standing in a shelter out of the wind and listening to it whistle above. But it wasn't worth a comet.
Sorry.
Right, okay. I'll check with Andy. Go over his gear for me, will you?
Sure.
What Gordy meant was, don't let Loretta pack for your son. It's hard enough hiking at that altitude without all the crap she'd make him carry. Hot water bottles, extra blankets, once even an alarm clock.
Harvey had to go back for his jacket and tie. When he came out of the garage, he went another way, into the backyard. He'd thought of asking Gordy, how do you feel about calling it Gordo's Bank and Coffee Clutch?
From the look on Gordy's face when the bank was mentioned, it wouldn't go over. Some kind of trouble there. Private trouble.
Andy was in the backyard, across the pool, playing basketball, solitaire. Randall stood quietly watching him. In zero time, in what must have been a year but felt like a week, Andy had changed from a boy into a stick figure, all arms and legs and hands, long bones poised behind a basketball. He launched it with exquisite care, danced to catch the rebound, dribbled, and fired again for a perfect score. Andy didn't smile. He nodded in somber satisfaction.
Kid's not bad, Harvey thought.
His pants were new, but they didn't reach his ankles. He'd be 15 next September, ready for high school, and there was nothing for it but to send him to Harvard School for Boys, certainly the best in Los Angeles. Only the school wanted a fortune just to hold a place, and the orthodontist wanted thousands now and more later. And there was the funny noise from the pool pump and the electronics club Andy was involved in. It wouldn't be long before the boy wanted a microcomputer for himself, and who could blame him? And Randall went inside, quietly, glad that Andy hadn't noticed him. A teenage boy used to be an asset. He could work in the fields, drive a team, or even a tractor. The pressure could be shared, shifted to younger shoulders. A man could ease off. There was wrapping paper in the kitchen wastebasket. Loretta had been shopping again. Christmas had been on charge accounts, and those bills would be coming to roost on his desk. He'd already heard the stock market report on the radio. The market was down. Loretta was nowhere around. Harvey went into the big dressing room off the bathroom and stripped, got into the shower. Hot water beat down on his neck, draining away tension. His mind was turned off. He imagined himself as meat being massaged by hydraulic pressure. Only, If only his mind would really turn off. Andy has a conscience. God knows I never tried to make him feel guilty. Discipline, sure. Punishment, standing in a corner, even a formal spanking. But when it's over. No lingering guilt. But he knows guilt anyway. If Andy knew what he's costing me in dollars and cents, and in the years of my life. If he ever knew what it does to the way I have to live, the shit I put up with to keep that goddamn job and win the bonuses that keep us afloat. What would Andy do if he knew? Run away. Get a job as a street sweeper in San Francisco to try to pay me back. He damned well is not going to know. A voice in the roar of water. Huh? Randall came out of the internal world and found Loretta smiling through the glass shower door. She mouthed, "Hi, how'd it go?" He waved. Loretta took it as an invitation. Randall watched her undress slowly, lasciviously, and slide through the glass door quick so the water wouldn't splash out. And it wasn't Wednesday. Harvey folded her in his arms. The water beat down on them, and they kissed. And it wasn't Wednesday. She asked, "How'd it go?" He had read her lips the first time, but she couldn't guess that. Now he had to answer. "I think they'll do it."
"I don't see why not. It doesn't make sense. If they wait, CBS will take it."
Right. The magic went out of the shower orgy scene. Poof.
"Isn't there any way to tell them how silly they're being?"
"No." Harvey fiddled with the shower head. The water expanded to a fine spray.
"Why not?"
"Because they know. Because they're not playing the same game we are."
"It all depends on you. If you insist on doing it your way, just once."
Loretta's hair darkened and dampened under the shower. She held him in her arms and looked up into his face, looking for the strengthening of purpose that would mean she'd convinced him that he would stand by his principles and force his superiors to face the consequences of their mistakes. "Yeah, it all depends on me, which makes me the obvious target if anything goes wrong. Turn around and I'll do your back." She turned her back. Harvey reached for the soap. His will loosed its hold on the muscles of his face. His soapy hands made patterns in the slippery contours of Loretta's back. Slowly, every move a caress. But he was thinking, "Don't you know what they'd do to me? They'd never fire me. But one day my office is an inside broom closet, the next day the rug is gone, then my phone doesn't work. By the time I quit, everyone in the industry has forgotten I exist, and we're still spending every cent I make." He had always loved Loretta's back. He searched his mind for growing lust, but he felt nothing. She was in on this from the beginning. It's her life, too. Not fair to lock her out. But she just won't understand. I can get Mark off a subject. He'll drink my beer and talk about something else if I make it plain enough. But I can't talk to Loretta like that. What I need is a drink. Loretta washed his back for him, and then they dried each other with the big towels. She was still trying to tell him how to handle the situation at the studio. She knew something was wrong, and as usual she probed at it, trying to understand, trying to help. Myriads of orbits later, when true humans were spreading through a world held fast in the grip of an ice age, the black planet came again. The comet was larger now. It had grown, snowflake by isolated snowflake, over 1,000 million years, until it was 4.5 miles across. But now its surface warmed in a bath of infrared heat. Within the comet's tissues, pockets of hydrogen and helium vaporized and seeped through the crust. The tiny sun was eclipsed. The ringed black disk covered a third of the sky, leaking the heat of its birth. Then it had passed, and calm returned. The comet had healed from a previous pass. Centuries, millennia, what are they in the cometary halo? But time had come at last to this comet. The black giant's passing had stopped it cold in its orbit. Slowly, urged by the faint tugging of the sun's gravity, it began to drop toward the maelstrom. February 2. It appears that the inner planets have ceaselessly been bombarded since their formation. Mars, Mercury, and Earth's moon have undergone repeated strikes by objects ranging in size from micrometeorites to whatever cracked the moon and created the large lava basin called Oceanus Procellarum. Although it was originally thought that Mars, because it was at the edge of the asteroid belt, experienced a higher rate of meteoric bombardment, examination of Mercury indicates that Mars is not exceptional, and the inner planets have approximately equal probabilities of being struck. Mariner, Preliminary Report. The travel-all was crammed with equipment, cameras, tape recorders, lights and reflectors, battery belts, the myriad paraphernalia of the roving TV interview. Charlie Bascom, cameraman, was in the back seat with the sound man Manuel Arguiles. Everything normal, except that Mark Chescu was in the front seat when Harvey came out of the NBS offices. Harvey beckoned to Mark. They walked across the studio lot toward Mercedes Row, where the executives parked. "Look," Harvey said, "your job title is production assistant. That theoretically makes you management. It has to be that way because of union rules."
"Yeah," Mark said, "but you aren't management. You're a gopher."
"I'm hip," Mark sounded hurt.
"Don't get upset and don't get huffy. Just understand. My crew has been with me a long time. They know the game. You don't."
"I know that, too."
"Fine. You can be a big help. Just remember, what we don't need is me telling everybody how to do their job." He flashed a big grin. "I like working for you. I won't blow it."
"Good." Harvey detected no signs of irony in Mark's voice. It made him feel better. He had been worried about this interview. It had to be said, but that didn't make it easier. One of his associates had once remarked that Mark was like a jungle. All right, but you had to chop him back every now and then, or he'd grow all over you. The travel-all started instantly. It had been through a lot with Harvey Randall. From the Alaska pipeline to the lower tip of Baja, even into Central America. They were old friends, the travel-all and Harvey. A big three-seat International Harvester four-wheel drive, truck motor, ugly as sin, and utterly reliable. He drove in silence to the Ventura Freeway and turned toward Pasadena. Traffic was light. "You know," Harvey said, "we're always complaining how nothing works, but here we are going 50 miles for this interview, and we count on being there in less than an hour. When I was a kid, a 50-mile trip was something you packed lunches for and hoped you'd make it by dark."
"What did you have, a horse?" Charlie asked.
"No, just L.A. without the freeways."
"Yuck."
They drove through Glendale and turned north on Linda Vista to go past the Rose Bowl. Charlie and Manuel talked about bets they'd lost a few weeks before.
"I thought Caltech owned JPL," Charlie said.
"They do," Mark told him.
"Sure put it way the hell far from Pasadena."
"Used to test jet engines there," Mark said. "JPL. Jet Propulsion Laboratories, right? Everybody thought they'd blow up, so they made Caltech put the labs out in the Arroyo."
He waved to indicate the houses outside.
"Then they built the most expensive suburb in this end of L.A., just around it."
The guard was expecting them. He waved them into a lot near one of the large buildings. JPL nestled into its Arroyo and filled it with office buildings. A big central steel and glass tower looked strangely out of place among the older Air Force Standard temporary structures erected 20 years before. There was a PR flak waiting for them. She led them through the routine, sign in, wear badges. Inside it looked like any other office building, but not quite. There were stacks of IBM cards in the corridors, and almost no one wore coats or ties. They passed a 10-foot color globe of Mars gathering dust in a corner. No one paid any attention to Harvey and his people. It wasn't unusual to see TV crews. JPL had built the Pioneer and Mariner space probes, had set Viking down on Mars.
"Here we are," the PR flak said.
The office looked good. Books on the wall, incomprehensible equations on the blackboards, books on every flat surface in view, IBM printouts all over the expensive teak desk.
Dr. Sharps, Harvey Randall,
the flack said. She hovered near the door. Charles Sharps wore glasses that curved around to cover his whole field of view, very modernistic, vaguely insectile against his long, pale face. His hair was black and straight, worn short. His fingers played with a felt-tip pen or fished into his pockets, always moving. He looked to be about 30, but he might have been older, and he wore a sport jacket and tie. "Now let's get this straight," Sharp said. "You want a lecture on comets, for yourself or for the public?"
"Both. Simple for the camera, as much as I can understand for me, if it's not too much trouble."
"Too much trouble?" Sharps laughed. "How could it be too much trouble? Your network tells NASA you want to do a documentary on space, and NASA sends up red rockets. Right, Charlene?"
The PR flack nodded. "They asked us to cooperate."
"Cooperate?" Sharps laughed again. "I'd jump through hoops if I thought it would help get a budget. When do we start?"
"Now, please," Harvey said. "The crew will set up while we chat. Just ignore them. I take it you're the resident expert on comets."
"I suppose so," Sharps said. "Actually, I like asteroids, but somebody has to study comets. I gather you're interested mainly in Hamner Brown."
"Right." Charlie caught Harvey's eye. They were ready. Harvey gave them the nod. Manuel listened and watched the indicator and said, "Speed." Mark stepped in front of the camera.
"Sharp's interview. Take one."
The chalkboard came together with a loud clack. Sharps jumped. They always did, first time. Charlie busied himself with the camera. He kept it aimed at Sharps. They'd film Harvey asking the questions later, when Sharps wasn't around.
"Tell me, Dr. Sharps, will Hamner Brown be visible to the naked eye?"
"Don't know," Sharps said. He sketched something unlikely on the IBM printout in front of him. The sketch might have been a pair of mating Loch Ness monsters.
"A month from now, we'll know much better. We already know it's going to get as close to the sun as Venus, but..."
He broke off and looked at the camera.
"What level do you want this at?"
"Anything you like," Harvey said. "Make me understand. Then we can decide how to tell the public." Sharps shrugged.
"All right. So there's the solar system out there."
He waved toward one wall. A big chart of the planets and their orbits hung next to the blackboard. "Planets and moons, always where they should be. They do a great, complicated dance around each other. Every planet, every moon, every little rock in the asteroid belt, all dancing to Newton's song of gravity. Mercury got a little out of step, and we had to revise the universe to make it fit."
"How's that?" Harvey asked, and I'd have preferred to do the poetry myself, but what the hell?
"Mercury. Orbit changes just a little every year. Not much, but more than Newton says it should. So a man named Einstein found a good explanation, and incidentally managed to make the universe a stranger place than it was before."
"Oh, I hope we don't need relativity to understand comets."
"No, no. But there's more than gravity to a comet's orbit."
"That's surprising, isn't it?"
"Yes. Are we going to have to revise the universe again?"
"What?
No, it's simpler than that. Look." Sharps jumped to his feet and was at the blackboard. He looked for chalk and muttered.
"Here you go."
Mark took chalk from his pocket and handed it.
"Thanks."
Sharps sketched a white blob, then a parabolic curve.
"That's the comet. Now let's put in planets."
He drew two circles.
"Earth and Venus."
"I thought planets moved in elliptical orbits," Harvey said.
"So they do, but on any scale you could draw, you can't see the difference. Now, look at the comet's orbit. Both arms of the curve look just the same, coming in and going out. Textbook parabola, right?"
"Right."
"But here's what the comet really looks like when it falls away from the sun. A dense nucleus. A coma of fine dust and gas." He was drawing again. "And a plume of dusty gas streaming away from the sun.
ahead of the comet, going out. The tail. A big tail. 100 million miles long, sometimes. But it's nearly a vacuum. It has to be. If it were thick, there wouldn't be enough matter in the comet to fill that much space.
Sure.
Okay. And again, like the textbooks, material boils out of the head of the comet into the coma. It's a thin gas, tiny particles, so tiny that sunlight can push them around. Light pressure from the sun makes them stream away, so the tail always faces away from the sun. Okay? Tail follows the comet going in, leads it coming out. But the stuff boils out unevenly. When the comet first falls into the system, it's a solid mass. We think. Nobody really knows. We have several models that fit the observations. Me, I like the dirty snowball model. The comet's made of rocks and dust. The dirt balled up with ices and frozen gases. Some water ice, methane, carbon dioxide, dry ice, cyanogen and nitrogen, all kinds of stuff. Pockets of these gases thaw and blast out to one side or the other. Like jet propulsion, and it changes the orbit. Sharps was at work with the chalk, holding it sideways. When he finished, the incoming arm had jogs and jiggle in it, and the outgoing arm was blurred into a wide sweep, not unlike the comet's tail. So we don't know how close to the Earth it's coming.
I see. And you don't know how big the tail will be.
Right. But this seems to be a new comet. Maybe it's never made the trip down close to the sun before. Not like Halley's Comet, which comes every 70 years and gets smaller each time. Comets die a little every time they pass near the sun. They lose all that tail material forever. So each time the tail's smaller, until eventually there's nothing left but the nucleus, and that comes as a handful of rocks. Meteor showers. Some of our best shooting stars are pieces of old comets falling onto Earth.
But this one's new.
That's right, so it ought to have a spectacular tail.
I seem to remember people said that about Kohoutek.
And I seem to remember they were wrong. Wasn't there an outfit selling commemorative medals that would show Kohoutek exactly as it appeared? You see, there's no way to know. But my guess is that Hamner Brown will be quite a sight, and it ought to pass fairly close to Earth.
Sharps drew a dot within the blur of the comet's outgoing course.
There's where we'll be. Of course, we won't see a lot until the comet passes the Earth, because until it gets by, we'll be looking straight into the sun to see it. Hard to observe then. But when it's past us, it should be quite a sight. There have been comets with tails across half the sky. See them in daytime. We're overdue for a big comet this century.
Hey, Doc, Mark said, you've got Earth right in that thing's path. Could it hit us?
Harvey turned to look daggers at Mark. Sharps was laughing. Chances are zillions to one against it. You see the Earth as a dot on the blackboard. Actually, if I drew this to scale, you wouldn't be able to see the Earth in the drawing, or the comet nucleus either. So what's the chance that a couple of pinpoints will come together? He frowned at the board. Of course, the tail is likely to go where we do. We might be in it for weeks.
What does that do? Harvey asked.
We went through the tail of Halley's Comet, Mark said. Didn't hurt a thing. Pretty lights and...
This time Harvey's look was enough.
Your friend's right, Sharps said.
I knew that.
Dr. Sharps, why do all the astronomers get so excited about Hamner Brown?
Harvey asked.
Man, we can learn a lot from comets. Things like the origins of the solar system. They're older than Earth, made out of primordial matter. This comet may have been out there way past Pluto for billions of years. Present theory says the solar system condensed from a cloud of dust and gas, an eddy in the interstellar medium. Most of that blew away when the sun started to burn, but some is still in the comet. We can analyze the tail, the way we did with Kohoutek. Kohoutek was no disappointment to astronomers. We used tools we'd never had before. Skylab, lots of things.
And that was useful? Harvey prompted.
Useful, It was magnificent. We should do it again.
Sharps's hands waved around in dramatic gestures. Harvey glanced quickly at his crew. The camera was rolling, and Manuel had that contented look a sound man has when things are going well in his phones.
"Could we get something like Skylab up there in time?" Harvey asked.
"Skylab? No.
But Rockwell's got an Apollo capsule we could use, and we've got the equipment here at the labs. There are big military boosters around, things the Pentagon doesn't need anymore. We could do it if we started now, and we weren't chicken about it."
Sharp's face fell.
"But we won't. Too damn bad, too. We could really learn something from Hamner Brown that way."
The cameras and sound equipment were packed away, and the crew went out with the PR lady. Harvey was saying his farewells to Sharps.
"Want some coffee, Harvey? You're in no hurry, are you?"
Sharps asked.
"Guess not."
Sharps punched a button on the phone console.
"Larry, get us some coffee, please."
He turned back to Harvey.
"Damnedest thing," he said. "Whole nation depends on technology. Stop the wheels for 2 days and you'd have riots. No place is more than 2 meals from a revolution. Think of Los Angeles or New York with no electricity. Or a longer view, fertilizer plants stop. Or a longer view yet, no new technology for 10 years. What happens to our standard of living?"
"Sure, we're a high-technology
"Yet," Sharps said. His voice was firm. He intended to finish. "Yet the damned fools won't pay 10 minutes' attention a day to science and technology. How many people know what they're doing? Where do these carpets come from? The clothes you're wearing? What do carburetors do? Where do sesame seeds come from? Do you know? Does one voter out of 30? They won't spend 10 minutes a day thinking about the technology that keeps them alive. No wonder the research budget has been cut to nothing. We'll pay for that. One day we'll need something that could have been developed years before but wasn't." He stopped himself. "Tell me, Harv, will this TV thing of yours be big, or will it get usual billing for a science program?"
"Prime time," Harvey said. "A series on the value of Hamner Brown, and incidentally on the value of science. Of course, I can't guarantee people won't turn to reruns of I Love Lucy."
"Yeah. Oh, thank you, Larry. Put the coffee right here."
Harvey had expected styrofoam cups and machine coffee. Instead, Sharps's assistant brought in a gleaming thermos pitcher, silver spoons, and sugar and cream service on an inlaid teak tray.
"Help yourself, Harvey. It's good coffee. Mocha Java?"
"Right," the assistant said.
"Good."
He waved dismissal.
"Harv, why this sudden change of heart by the networks?"
Harvey shrugged. "Sponsor insists on it. The sponsor happens to be Calva Soap, which happens to be controlled by Timothy Hamner, who happens..." Harvey was cut off by shrieks of laughter. Sharps's thin face contorted in glee.
"Beautiful!"
Then he looked thoughtful.
"A series. Tell me, Harv, if a politician helped us with the study, helped a lot, could he be worked into the series, get some favorable publicity?"
"Sure. Hamner would insist on it. Not that I'd object."
"Marvelous."
Sharps lifted his coffee cup.
"Cheers." "Thanks, Harv. Thanks a lot. I think we'll be seeing more of each other."
Sharps waited until Harvey Randall had left the building. He sat very still, something unusual for him, and he felt excitement in the pit of his stomach. It might work. It just might. Finally, he punched the intercom.
"Larry, get me Senator Arthur Jellison in Washington."
"Thanks." Then he waited impatiently until the phone buzzed.
"He'll talk to you," his assistant said.
Sharps lifted the phone.
"Sharps here."
Another wait while the secretary got the senator.
"Charlie?"
"Right," Sharps said.
"Art, I've got a proposition for you. Know about the comet?"
"Comet?
Oh, comet. Funny you mention that. I met the guy who discovered it. Turns out he was a heavy contributor, but I never met him before."
"Well, it's important," Sharp said. "Opportunity of the century."
"That's what they said about Kohoutek."
Goddamn Kahootek. Look, Art, what's the chance we could get funding for a probe?
How much?
Well, take two cases. Second best is anything we can get. The lab can cobble up an unmanned black box, something that goes on a Thor Delta.
No problem. I can get you that, Jellison said.
But that's second best. What we need is a manned probe. Say, two men in an Apollo with some equipment instead of the third man. Art, that comet's going to be close. From up there we could get good pictures, not just the tail, not just the coma. There's a fair chance we could get pics of the head. Know what that means?
Not really, but you just told me it's important. Jellison was silent for a moment. Sorry, I really am, but there's no chance. Not one chance. Anyway, we couldn't put up an Apollo if we had the budget.
Yes, we can. I just checked with Rockwell. Higher risk missions than NASA likes, but we could do it. We've got the hardware.
Doesn't matter. I can't get you a budget for that. Sharps frowned at the phone. The sick excitement rose in his stomach. Arthur Jellison was an old friend, and Charlie Sharps did not like blackmail. But...
Not even if the Ruskies are putting up a Soyuz.
What?
But they're not. Oh, yes, they are, Sharps said. And it's not a lie. Not really. Just an anticipation.
You can prove that.
In a few days. Rely on it. They're going up to look at Hamner Brown.
I will be dipped in shit.
I beg your pardon, Senator.
I will be dipped in shit.
Oh.
You're playing games with me, aren't you, Charlie? Jellison demanded.
Not really. Look, Art, it's important, and we need another manned mission anyway, just to keep up interest in space. You've been after a manned flight.
Yeah, but I had no chance of getting one.
There was more silence. Then Jellison said, more to himself than Sharps,
So the Ruskies are going, and no doubt they'll make a big deal of it.
I'm sure they will.
Another silence. Charlie Sharps almost held his breath.
Okay, Jellison said. I'll nose around the hill and see what kind of reactions I get, but you better be giving it to me straight.
Senator, in a week you'll have unmistakable evidence.
All right, I'll give it a try.
Anything else?
Not just now.
Okay. Thanks for the tip, Charlie.
The phone went dead.
Abrupt he is, Sharps thought.
He smiled thinly to himself, then punched the intercom button again.
Larry, I want Dr. Sergei Fadayev in Moscow, and yes, I know what time it is over there. Just get him on for me.
The legend of Gilgamesh was a handful of unconnected tales spreading through the Earth's fertile crescent in Asia, and the comet was nearly unchanged. It was still far outside the maelstrom. The orbit of the runaway moon called Pluto would have looked like a quarter held nearly on edge at arm's length. The sun, an uncomfortably bright pinpoint, still poured far less heat across the comet's crust than had the black giant at its worst. The crust was mostly water ice now. It reflected most of the heat back to the stars. Yet time passed. Mars swallowed its water in another turn of its long, vicious weather cycle. Men spread across the Earth, laughing and scratching, and the comet continued to fall. A breath of the solar wind, high-velocity protons, flayed its crust. Much of the hydrogen and helium in its tissues had seeped away. The maelstrom came near.
March 1.
And the Lord hung a rainbow as a sign. Won't be water, but fire next time.
Traditional spiritual.
Mark Chescu looked up at the house and whistled. It was California Tudor, off-white stucco with massive wood beams inset at angles. They'd be real wood. Some places, like Glendale, had the same style of house with plywood strips to fake it, but not Bel Air. The house was large, on a large lot. Mark rang the front doorbell.
Presently it was opened by a young man with long hair and pencil-thin mustache. He looked at Mark's Rough Rider trousers and boots and at the large brown cases Mark had set on the porch. "We don't need any," he said.
"I'm not selling any. I'm Mark Chescu from NBS.
"Oh, sorry. You'd be surprised how many peddlers we get. Come on in. My name's George. I'm the houseboy." He lifted one of the cases.
"Heavy."
"Yeah." Mark was busy looking around. Paintings. A telescope. Globes of Earth, Mars, and the Moon. Glass statuary. Steuben crystal. Trip toys. The front room had been set up as for a theater party. Couches facing the TV.
"Must have been a bitch moving that stuff," Mark said.
"Sure was. Here, put that in here. Anything tricky about it?"
"Not if you know video recorders."
"I ought to," George said. "I'm a drama student, UCLA. But we haven't had that course yet. You better show me."
"Will you be running it tonight?"
"Nah, I've got a rehearsal. Wild Duck. Good part. Mr. Hamner will do it."
"Then I'll show him."
"You'll have to wait, then. He's not home yet. Want a beer?"
"That'd go nice."
Mark followed George to the kitchen. A big room, gleaming chrome and formica everywhere. Two double sinks, two gas ovens, two ranges. A large counter held trays of canapes covered with saran wrap. There was a desk and bookshelves which held cookbooks, the latest Travis McGee thrillers, and Stanislavski's An Actor Prepares. Only the thrillers and Stanislavski showed any signs of use.
"I'd have thought Hamner would find himself an astronomy student."
"Last guy here was," George said. He got out beer. "They fought a lot."
"So Hamner fired him?"
"No, he sent him up to his place in the mountains. Hamner likes to fight, but not when he's at home. He's easy to work for. And there's color TV in my room, and I get to use the pool and sauna."
"Hard to take," Mark sipped at the beer. "This must be one swinging party pad."
George laughed.
"Like hell. The only parties are when I bring in a showcast, or, like tonight, relatives."
Mark eyed George carefully. Pencil mustache, actor's fine features. What the hell, he thought.
"Hamner gay or something?"
"Christ, no," George said. "No, he just doesn't want to go out much. I fixed him up with the second lead in our last show. Nice girl, from Seattle. Hamner took her out a couple of times, then nothing. Irene said he was polite and a perfect gentleman until they were alone. Then he leaped at her."
"She should have leaped back."
"That's what I said, but she didn't." George cocked his head to one side. "That's Mr. Hamner coming now. I recognize the engine." Tim Hamner went to the side door and into the small suite that he thought of as his home. It was the part of the house he felt most comfortable in, although he used the whole place. Hamner didn't like his house. It had been chosen by the family money managers for resale value, and it had that. It gave him plenty of space to display the things he'd collected, but it didn't seem like a home. He poured himself a short scotch and sank into an Eames chair. He put his feet up on the matching footstool. It felt good. He'd done his duty. He'd gone to a director's meeting and listened to all the reports and congratulated the company president on the quarterly earnings. Tim's natural inclination was to let those who liked playing with money do it, but he'd had a cousin who'd lost everything that way. It never hurt to let money managers know you were looking over their shoulders. Thinking of the meeting reminded him of the secretary at the office. She'd chatted pleasantly with Tim before the meeting, but she'd pleaded a date when he asked her for dinner for tomorrow. Maybe she did have a date. She was polite enough, but she'd turned him down. Maybe, he thought, maybe I should have asked her for next Friday, or next week. But then if she said no, there'd have been no doubt about why. He heard George talking with someone out in the living room and wondered idly who it might be. George wouldn't disturb him until he came out. That was one nice thing about this house. He could have this suite to himself. But then Tim remembered. That would be the man from NBS. With the cut scenes, the ones Tim had liked but hadn't got into the documentary. He got up in enthusiasm and began changing clothes. Penelope Wilson arrived about 6. She had never answered to Penny. Her mother had insisted. Tim Hamner, looking at her through the spy hole in the door, suddenly remembered that she had given up Penelope, too. She'd taken to using her middle name, and Tim couldn't remember it.
Be brave.
He threw the door wide and, letting his agony show, cried, Quick, what's your middle name?
Joyce. Hello, Tim. Am I the first?
Yes, you look elegant.
He took her coat.
He had known her forever, since grade school, anyway. Penelope Joyce had gone to the same girls' prep school as Tim's sister and a half-dozen girl cousins. She had been the homely one, with her wide mouth and two-square jaw, and a figure best described as sturdy. In college, she had begun to bloom. She was indeed elegant tonight. Her hair was long and wavy and complexly arranged. Her dress was clean of line and of a color and texture soft to the eye. Tim wanted to touch it. He'd lived with his sister long enough to know how long it must have taken to get that effect, even if he had no hint as to how it was done. Wanting her approval was automatic. He waited as she inspected his living room, wondering to himself why he'd never invited her before. Finally, she looked up with an expression Tim hadn't seen her use since high school, when she'd decided she was judge of all morals.
"Nice room," she said approvingly. Then she giggled, ruining the pose.
"Glad you like it. Damned glad, in fact."
"Really? Is my opinion so important?"
She was still teasing him with facial expressions from their childhood.
"Yes. In a few minutes, the whole damned family's going to be here, and most of them haven't seen this place. You think like they do, so if you like it, they will." I guess I deserved that."
"Hey, I didn't mean..." She was laughing at him again. He got her a drink, and they sat.
"I've been wondering," she mused. "We haven't seen each other for 2 years at least. Why did you ask me here tonight?"
Tim was partly prepared for that. She had always been direct. He decided to be truthful. "I was thinking about who I wanted here tonight. A big ego thing, right? The show about my comet. And I thought of Gil Waters, the top of my class at Kate, and my family, and you. Then I realized I was thinking of all the people I wanted to impress most."
"Me?"
"Right. We used to talk, remember? And I never could tell you what I wanted to do with my life. The rest of my family, everyone we grew up with, they make money, or collect art, or race cars, or do something. Me? I only wanted to watch the sky."
She smiled. "I'm really flattered, Tim."
"You really do look elegant. Your own creation."
"Yes, thank you."
She was still easy to talk to. Tim was finding that a pleasant rediscovery when the doorbell rang. The others had come. It was a pleasant evening. The caterers had done their job well, so there was no trouble with the food, even without George to help. Tim relaxed and found he was having fun. They listened. They never had before. They listened as Tim told them how it had been, the cold, dark hours of watching, of studying star patterns, of keeping the log, of endless hours poring over photographs, all with no result except the joy of knowing the universe. And they listened. Even Greg, who usually made no secret of how he felt about rich men who didn't pay proper attention to their money. It was only a family gathering in Tim's living room, but he was elated and nervous and quiveringly alert. He saw Barry's smile and head shake and read Barry's mind from that. What a way to spend a life. "He's actually envying me," Tim thought, and it was delicious. Tim glanced up to catch his sister watching with wry amusement. Jill had always been able to tell what Tim was thinking. He'd been closer to her than either had been to their brother, Pat. But it was Pat who trapped him behind the bar and wanted to talk.
"Like your place," Pat said. "Mom doesn't know what to make of it."
He tilted his head to indicate where their mother was wandering around the room, looking at gadgets. At the moment, she was fascinated by the calliroscope's random and strange patterns.
"Bet I know what she's thinking."
"Do you?"
"Do I what?"
"Bring girls here. Have wild parties."
None of your goddamn business.
Pat shrugged. Too bad. Man, there are times when I wish I... To hell with it. But you really ought to take advantage. You won't have forever. Mom will have her way.
Sure, Tim said.
Why the hell did Pat have to bring that up? His mother would, before the night was over.
Timmy, why aren't you married yet?
One day I'll answer, Tim told himself. One day I'll say it.
Because every time I find a girl I think I could live with, you scare her spitless and she runs away. That's why.
I'm still hungry, Penelope Joyce announced.
Good Lord, Jill patted her stomach. Where do you put it? I want your secret. Only don't tell me it's your clothes. Greg says we can't afford your creations.
Penelope took Tim's hand.
Come on, show me where the popcorn is. I'll shake, you get the bowls.
But
they'll find their own drinks.
She led him to the kitchen.
Let them talk about you while you're out here. They'll admire you even more.
After all, you're the star tonight.
Think so?
He looked into her eyes.
I can never tell when you're putting me on.
There's luck.
Where's the butter?
The show was great. Tim knew that when he saw his family watching it, watching him on television. Randall had gone all over the world, showing amateur astronomers staring at the sky. Most comets are discovered by amateurs, Randall said. The public rarely appreciates how much these sky watchers aid the big observatories. Of course, some amateurs aren't amateur at all. The scene cut to Tim Hamner showing off his mountain observatory and his assistant, Marty, demonstrating equipment. Tim had thought the sequence would be too short, but when he watched his family watching him and it ended with them eager for more, he realized that Harv Randall had been right. Always leave them wanting a little more. And, Randall's voice said, some are more amateur than others. The camera zoomed in on a smiling teenage boy with a telescope. The instrument looked competent, but it was obviously home-built. Gavin Brown of Centerville, Iowa. Gavin, how did you happen to be looking for comets at the right time and place?
I wasn't.
Brown's voice was not pleasant. He was young and shy, and he talked too loud.
I made some adjustments to the setting circles because I wanted to look at Mercury in the daytime. Only you have to have everything adjusted right to find Mercury, because it's so close to the sun, and...
So you found Hamner Brown by accident, Harvey Randall said. Greg McCleave laughed. Jill gave her husband a sharp look. Tell me, Gavin, Randall said, since you didn't see the comet until well after Mr. Hamner did, but you reported it almost at the same instant, how did you know it was a new comet?
It was something that didn't belong there.
You mean you know everything that does belong there, Randall said. The screen showed a photograph of the sky around Hamner Brown. It was full of stars.
Sure, doesn't everybody?
He does, too, Tim said.
He stayed here a week, and I swear he can draw star maps from memory.
He stayed here? Tim's mother asked.
Sure, in the spare room.
Oh, Tim's mother stared very hard at the set.
Where's George tonight?
Jill asked.
Another date. Mother, did you know that Tim's houseboy has been dating Linda Gilray?
Pass the popcorn,
Penelope Joyce said.
Where is Brown now, Tim?
Back in Iowa.
Those commercials sell much soap, Greg asked. He pointed at the set.
Calva does all right, Tim said. 26.4% of the market last year.
Geez, they must be better than I thought, Greg said. Who's your advertising man?
Then the program was on again. There wasn't much more about Tim Hamner. Once discovered, Hamner Brown Comet was the world's. Now the star was Charles Sharp's, who talked about comets and the importance of knowing the sun and planets and stars. Tim wasn't disappointed, but he thought the others were, except for Pat, who watched Sharp's and kept nodding. Once Pat looked up and said, "If I'd had a science professor like him in my freshman year, I might have discovered a comet myself. Do you know him very well?"
"Sharps? Never met him. But I've got more of him on the video recordings," Tim said. "There's more of me, too."
Greg pointedly glanced at his watch. "Gotta be in the office at 5 a.m., he said. "The market's going crazy, and after that show, it will be worse."
"Huh?" Tim frowned. "Why?"
"Comets," Greg said. "Signs in the sky. Portents of evil change. You'd be surprised how many investors take things like that seriously. Not to mention that diagram the professor drew, the one that showed the comet hitting Earth."
"But it didn't," Pat protested.
"Tim, could it?"
his mother demanded.
"Of course not. Didn't you listen? Sharp said it was billions to one," Tim said.
"I saw it," Greg said, "and he said comets did hit the Earth sometimes, and this one will be close."
"But he didn't mean it that way," Tim protested.
Greg shrugged. "I know the market. I'm going to be in the office when the big board opens."
The phone rang. Tim looked puzzled. Before he could get up, Jill answered it. She listened for a moment, then looked puzzled as well.
"It's your answering service. They want to know whether they should put through a call from New York."
"Eh?"
Tim got up to take the phone. He listened. On the TV, a NASA official was explaining how they might, just might, be able to get up a probe to study the comet. Tim put the phone down.
"You look dazed," Penelope Joyce said.
"I am dazed. That was one of the producers. They want me to be a guest on the Tonight Show. With Dr. Sharps, Pat, so I'll meet him after all."
"I watch Johnny every night,"
Tim's mother said. She said it admiringly. People who got on the Tonight Show were important. Randall's documentary ended in a blaze of glory, with photographs of the sun and stars taken by Skylab, and a strong plea for a manned probe to explore Hamner-Brown Comet. Then came the last commercial, and Tim's audience was leaving. Tim realized, not for the first time, just how far apart they'd grown. He really didn't have much to say to the head of a stockbroker firm, or to a man who built townhouses, even if they were his brother-in-law and his brother. He found himself mixing drinks for himself and Penelope, Joyce, alone. "It felt like opening night in a bad play," Tim said.
"In Boston with an allegory, and the Shriners are in town," Joyce teased.
He laughed.
"Ha! Haven't seen light up the sky since... by golly, since you were in that summer drama thing. And you're right, that's what it was like.
Pooh.
Pooh?
Pooh. You always did think like that. And there never was any reason to, and there isn't one now. You can be proud, Tim. What's next? Another comet?"
"No, I don't think so." He squeezed lime into her gin and tonic and handed it to her.
"I don't know. I'm not strong enough on theory to do what I really want."
"So learn the theory."
"Maybe."
He came around and sat next to her.
"But anyway, I made the history books."
"Skoll."
She lifted her drink in salute. She wasn't mocking him.
"Skoll."
He sipped at his drink.
"I'll follow it as far as it goes, whatever else I do. Randall wants another documentary, and we'll do it if the ratings aren't too bad."
"Ratings?
You worry about ratings?"
"You're teasing me again."
"Not this time."
All right. I'll back another documentary, because I want it. We'll go heavy on the space probe. With enough publicity, we might get the probe up, and somebody like Sharps really will understand comets.
Thanks."
She put a hand on his arm.
"You're welcome. Run with it, Tim. Nobody else here tonight has done half of what they want to do. You've already got 3/4 and a shot at the rest."
He looked at her and thought, "If I married her, Mom would heave a great sigh of relief. She was in that limited class of women. They all seemed to know his sister, Jill. They'd gone east to college and to New York during vacations. They'd broken the same rules. They were not afraid of their mothers. They were beautiful and frightening. The sex urge in a teenage boy was too powerful, too easily twisted and repressed. It made the beauty of a young woman into a flame, and when that flame was coupled to total self-confidence, a girl like any of Jill's friends could be a fearsome thing to a boy who had never believed in himself. Joyce wasn't fearsome. She wasn't pretty enough." She frowned.
What are you thinking?
God, no. He couldn't answer that one.
I was remembering a lot.
Had he been deliberately left alone with Joyce? Certainly she had stayed after the others had left. If he made a pass now. But he didn't have the courage, or, he told himself, the kindness. She was elegant, yes, but you don't go to bed with a Steuben crystal vase. He got up and went to the video recorder.
Want to watch some of the other clips?
For a moment, she hesitated. She looked at him carefully, then just as carefully drained her glass and set it on the coffee table.
Thanks, Tim, but I'd better get some sleep. There's a buyer coming in tomorrow.
She was still smiling when she left.
Tim thought it a bit forced.
Or he wondered, am I just flattering myself? The maelstrom was intolerably crowded. Masses of all sizes whirled past each other, warping space into a complex topology that changed endlessly. The inner moons and planets were all scar tissue, worn craters beneath the atmospheres of Earth and Venus, naked ring walls and frozen lakes of magma spread across the faces of Mars, Mercury, Earth's moon. Here was even the chance of escape. The gravity fields around Saturn and Jupiter could fling a comet back out into the cold and the dark. But Saturn and Jupiter were wrongly placed, and the comet continued to fall, accelerating, boiling. Boiling. Pockets of volatile chemicals burst and spurted away in puffs of dust and ice crystals. Now the comet moved in a cloud of glowing fog that might have shielded it from the heat, but didn't. Instead, the fog caught the sunlight across thousands of cubic miles and reflected it back to the comet head from every direction. Heat at the surface of the nucleus seeped inward. More pockets of gas ruptured and fired like attitude jets on a spacecraft, tossing the comet head this way and that. Masses tugged at it as it passed, lost and blind and falling. The dying comet dropped past Mars, invisible within a cloud of dust and ice crystals the size of Mars itself. A telescope on Earth found it as a blurred point near Neptune.
March. Interludes.
None of the astronauts ever walked on solid lunar rock, because everywhere they have gone there was soil underfoot. This powdery layer is present because the moon has been bombarded by meteorites throughout geologic time. The unceasing barrage has so pulverized the surface that it has created a residual layer of rocky debris several meters thick. Dr. John A. Wood, Smithsonian Institution. Fred Lauren made delicate adjustments to the telescope. It was a big instrument, a 4-inch refractor on a heavy tripod. The apartment cost him too much money, but he had to have it for the location. His only furniture was a cheap couch, a few cushions on the floor, and the big telescope. Fred watched a darkened window a quarter mile away. She had to come home soon. She always did. What could she be doing? She'd left alone. No one had come for her. The thought frightened him, then made him sick. Suppose she had met a man somewhere. Had they gone for dinner, and then to his apartment? Even now he might be putting his filthy hands on her breasts. He would have hairy hands, rough, like a mechanic's, and they would be sliding downward, caressingly down across the flat curve of her belly. No, she wasn't that kind. She wouldn't let anyone do that to her. She wouldn't. But all women did. Even his mother. Fred Lauren shuddered. Unwanted, the memory came back when he was just 9, when he'd gone in to ask his mother to say his prayers, and she'd been lying on the bed with the man he called Uncle Jack on top of her. She was moaning and writhing, and Uncle Jack had leaped from the bed.
"You little bastard! I'll cut your goddamn balls off! You want to watch? You'll sure to God watch. Stand there, and if you say one word, I'll cut your prick off."
He'd watched, and his mother had let that man. The window came alight. She was home. Fred held his breath.
Was she alone? Was she?
She was carrying a big bag of groceries, which she took to the kitchen. Now she'll have her drink, Fred thought. I wish she wouldn't drink so much. She looks tired. He watched as the girl mixed a martini. She carried the pitcher with her to the kitchen. Fred didn't follow with the telescope, although he could have. Instead, he teased himself, waiting. Her face was triangular, with high cheekbones and a small mouth and big dark eyes. Her long, flowing blonde hair was tinted. Her pubic hair was very dark. Fred had forgiven her that small deception, but he'd been shocked. She came back with the pitcher and a glass spoon. There was a silver-handled martini spoon in the gift shop down the street, and Fred had often stared at it, trying to get up the nerve to buy it for her. Maybe she'd invite him to her apartment. Only she wouldn't until he'd given her gifts, and he couldn't do that because he knew what she liked, and she'd want to know how he knew that. Fred Lauren reached out to touch her through the magic mirror of his telescope, but only in his mind, only in his hopeless yearning. Now she'd do it. She didn't have many dresses good enough to wear to work. She worked in a bank, and although the banks let the girls wear trousers and all the ugly things girls were wearing lately, she didn't. Not Colleen. He knew her name. He wanted to keep his money in her bank, but he didn't dare. She dressed well to win promotions, and she'd been promoted to new accounts, and Fred couldn't talk to her there. He was proud of her promotion, but he wished she'd stayed a teller, because then he could come in and go to her window and... She took off the blue frock and carefully hung it in the only closet. Her apartment was very small, only one room with a bathroom and kitchen alcove. She slept on the couch. Her slip was frayed. He'd watched her mending the straps at night. Under the slip she wore lacy black underpants. He could see the color through the slip. Sometimes she wore pink ones with black stripes. Soon she'd be taking her bath. Colleen took long baths. Fred could be knocking at her door before she finished. She'd open the door. She trusted people. Once she'd opened the door wearing nothing but a towel, and the man outside had been a telephone man. And another time it was the building superintendent, and Fred knew he could imitate the super's voice. He'd followed the super to a bar and listened to him. She would open the door. But he couldn't do it. He knew what he'd do if she opened her door to him. He knew what would happen afterward. This would be his third time. Third sex offense. They'd lock him up with those men, those animals. Fred remembered what the caged men had called him and how they had used him. He whimpered, throttling the sound as if she might hear. She put on her robe. Her dinner was in the oven, and she sat in the robe and turned on the TV set. Fred scurried across the room to turn on his own set and tune it to the same channel, then moved quickly back to the telescope. Now he could watch over her shoulder, watch her own TV, and hear the sound, and it was as if Fred and his girl were watching TV together. It was a program about a comet. The stocky man's hands were large and smooth, slender, stronger than they looked. They moved over Maureen, knowingly, cunningly. "Purr," said Maureen. She pulled him suddenly against her and arched sideways, wrapping him in her long legs. He gently pushed her away and continued to stroke her, playing her like the attitude jets on a lunar lander. The bizarre image stuck in her mind, jarring. His lips moved against her breast, his tongue darting. Then it was time, and she could lose herself in him. She had no thought of technique now, but he had. He was always in control. He wouldn't be finished until she was, and she could depend on it. And now there was no time for thought, only the waves of shuddering feeling. She came home from a long way away. They lay together, breathing each other's breath. Finally, he stirred against her. She caught a handful of curly hair and tilted his face up. Standing, he was just her height. Astronauts are generally short. Lying above her, his head reached her throat. She lifted herself to kiss him and sighed contentment.
but now her mind was turned on again. "I wish I loved him," she said to herself. "Why don't I? Because he's too invulnerable." "Johnny, does your mind ever turn off?"
He thought it through before answering.
"There's a story they tell about John Glenn." He rolled onto an elbow. "The space medicine boys were trying to find out what we could go through and still function. They had John Glenn wired with widgets so they could watch his heartbeat and perspiration while he went through a program on the Gemini flight simulator. Right in the middle of it, they dropped a shitload of scrap iron onto a tilted iron plate right behind him. The whole room rang with it, and it went on and on. Glenn's heartbeat went blip."
Johnny's fingers sketched a teepee shape.
"He never even twitched. He went through the whole sequence, and then he said, 'You sons of bitches.'"
He watched her laugh, and then he said, a bit sadly,
"We can't get distracted." He sat up. "If we're going to watch your program, we ought to be getting up."
"Yes, I suppose."
"You first."
"Right." He bent to kiss her again, then left the bed. She heard the shower running and thought of joining him, but he wouldn't be interested now. She'd said the wrong thing, and now he'd be remembering his ruined career. Ruined not by any mistake of his, but by America's retreat from space. She found his robe where he'd left it for her. Forethought. "We can't get distracted. One thing at a time, and do that perfectly. Whether it was crawling along a ruined Skylab and repairing it in orbit, or conducting a love affair, he did it right, and he was never in a hurry." When they met, Baker had been in the astronaut office in Houston and was assigned as liaison to Senator Jellison and party. Johnny Baker had a wife and two teenage kids and had been a perfect gentleman, taking Maureen to dinner when the senator was called away, keeping her company for the week the senator was in Washington, taking her to the launch in Florida. A perfect gentleman up to the time they'd had to go back to her motel room for her purse, and she still wasn't sure who had seduced whom. She didn't sleep with married men. She didn't like sleeping with men she didn't love, for that matter. But love aside, he had something, and Maureen had no defense against it. He had a single goal and the ability to go after it no matter what. And she was young and had been married once and had taken no vow of chastity. And the hell with what you're thinking, girl. Maureen rolled off the bed fast and switched on the TV with a vicious click, just to break the chain of thought. "But I am not a tramp. His divorce is final next week, and I had nothing to do with that. Anne never knew. Anne doesn't know now. But maybe he wouldn't have let her go. If that's my fault, all right, but Anne never knew. We're still good friends."
"He's not the same anymore," Anne had told her. "Not since he flew the mission. Before that, it was always tough here. He was on training missions all the time, and I had only a little part of him, but I had something. And then he got his chance, and everything worked fine, and my husband's a hero, and I don't have a husband anymore."
Anne couldn't understand it. "I can," Maureen thought. "It wasn't flying the mission. It was that there aren't any more missions. And if you're Johnny Baker and all your life you've worked and trained to do one thing, and nobody's ever going to do that again. One goal in life. Tim Hamner had a touch of that. Johnny had it. And maybe she had tried to borrow a piece of it. And now look. Johnny had used up his one goal, and the most important thing in Maureen Jellison's life was a fight with a silly Washington hostess. It still bothered her every time she thought of it. Annabelle Cole was liberated. 6 months ago, it had been the threatened extinction of the snail skimmer. In 6 months more, it might be the decline of artistic tradition among Australian blackfellas. At the moment, there was nothing for it but to blame men for everything bad that had ever happened. Nobody really minded. They didn't dare. No mean amount of the world's business was conducted at Annabelle's parties. Maureen must have been edgy the night Annabelle braced her for her father's support. Annabelle wanted Congress to fund studies on artificial wombs, to free women from months of slavery to their suddenly altered bodies.
And I told her, Maureen thought, I told her that having babies was part of the sex act, and if she was willing to give up being pregnant, she could give up fucking, too. I said that, and I never had a baby in my life. Dad might miss some important contacts through his daughter's exercise intact, but Maureen could handle that. In 6 months, when Annabelle found a new cause, Maureen would host a party and invite someone Annabelle had to meet. She had it all worked out. That was the problem, as if a fight with Annabelle Cole was the most important event in her life. "I'll fix some drinks," Johnny called. "Best get your shower. The program's on in a minute." "Yo," she answered, and she thought, "Him? Marry the man? Promote him a new career? Get him to run for office? Or write his memoirs? He'd be good at anything he tried. But why couldn't she find goals of her own?"